Welcome to this latest event in this year's Proms Literary Festival. As tonight's Proms concert features Beethoven's First and Fifth Symphonies, we're talking about the man whose work embodies Romantic music, whom one contemporary called an exponent of heaven-born art that would live to the end of time. But how much of our idea of Beethoven is an idealized version of the Romantic artist? After all, he stands in that pantheon of figures who seem to have been inspired by something that goes beyond the purely rational, from Byron to Baudelaire to Jackson Pollock. We remember the passion, the tantrums, the hair. But how influential has Beethoven been in our idea of what a true artist is? Well, debating the question, we have two maestros here tonight. Filmmaker Phil Grabsky's documentary In Search of Beethoven was released last year to great acclaim. And he's become renowned for his award-winning films whose subjects range from Muhammad Ali to post-Taliban Afghanistan. Historian Tim Blanning is Professor of History at Cambridge University and one of the most distinguished analysts of modern Europe. But he's also author of The Triumph of Music, a history of music and musicians over the past two centuries. And Henry Goodman, who won an Olivier Award for his portrayal of Shylock at the National Theatre and appeared in Ang Lee's film Taking Woodstock, will be reading for us. Tim, I wonder if we could get to the heart of the matter here. We've all heard the term romantic artist, but I'm wondering what exactly is the proper definition of that term?
Well, I can help you there, I think, and I'm glad you used the phrase the heart of the matter, because that's really where we want to start. And Beethoven himself delivered a very pithy definition of romanticism, although that wasn't his intention at the time, when he wrote on the score of the Missa Solemnis, which he regarded as his most important work, from the heart, may it go to the heart. And that, it seems to me, really is the essence of the Romantic project, is that it comes from inside the creative artist. It is a culture which is from the inside out. Beethoven himself takes us to that crucial definition, but it can be elaborated on almost at will, of course.
Well, of course, there is a culture that surrounds the idea of the romantic, and I must say the poet Goethe comes to mind here. I mean, there's this strong idea of Sturm und Drang, storm and stress, isn't there?
Yes, and there's a very happy coincidence of dates there, of course, because Beethoven is born in 1770. He's born into a world which is about to be turned upside down. And within 6 years, the American Revolution is underway. At the age of 19, the French Revolution breaks out. Napoleon had been born the year before in 1769. The Industrial Revolution is underway. And also, I would argue that there's another, and in a way, even more durable revolution, the Romantic Revolution, underway.
Could you just tell us briefly, this term we've all heard, probably more in German, Tim, Sturm und Drang, what does it mean?
Being literally translated, it means storm and stress. It's a movement, a short-lived movement, but a very important, influential movement of the 1770s. It's a movement of angry young men. These are men in their teens and 20s who are tearing up the old, enlightened, classical rulebook. What they want is to get away from, as they saw it, the desiccated, stuffy old world of reason and into a world of passion and feeling and authenticity and inwardness.
Okay, well, passion and Goethe brings to mind our first reading. Henry.
These are Goethe's comments on his meeting with Beethoven at Teplitz in 1812. I've never seen an artist more concentrated, more energetic and intense. I can understand quite well that his relationship to the world must be a strange one.
Phil, living in a particularly strange world, you're an artist yourself, you're a documentary filmmaker. Does that idea of Goethe ring true for you?
To some extent, but I think the role of being an artist hasn't really changed a great deal in 200 years. I think that economics is a key part to it. It was for Beethoven and it is for any filmmaker today. You have to have a passion, you have to have an inquisitiveness. What fuels me as a filmmaker is a desire to explore and try to communicate that. And I think that was something that clearly Beethoven had as well. For me, what I try to do as a filmmaker is to try to understand how they got from being this small baby born in Bonn in 1770 to this person that we have elevated to being one of the great composers of all time.
And part of that comes from him being soaked, being enveloped in that culture that Tim's mentioned. I mean, What would Beethoven have been reading? Who was he listening to?
Well, Beethoven was listening and heavily influenced by people like Mozart, of course, and Haydn and Cannabich. And I mean, there's so many. In those days, you would only really hear the work of Mozart pretty much if Mozart was playing it himself. There weren't kind of travelling orchestras going around Europe playing the works of. Nevertheless, those musicians that came through Bonn and later came through Vienna, Beethoven made sure he went to listen to them. He went to talk to the musicians.
Perhaps I could add just a little bit to that. Beethoven, of course, was first and foremost a musician and was influenced primarily by other musicians. But he was highly intelligent and he did read very widely. And the kind of people he was reading were those poets of Sturm und Stress, Sturm und Drang, young Goethe and Schiller. Schiller was a huge influence on him, incidentally. Of course, it was Schiller who wrote the words for the Ninth Symphony, but he'd actually considered writing music to words by Schiller way back in the 1790s. So although he's an untutored genius, he is a genius and he made up for lost ground.
Could you explain something that comes from that, Tim? You've talked about him as someone who's taking part in this kind of romantic, passionate attempt to kind of tear up Enlightenment values as part of the Sturm und Stress. But I also associate Beethoven very much with being a figure of the Enlightenment. How does he reconcile those two seemingly contradictory impulses?
No, I don't think that is contradictory. In the House of the Enlightenment, there were many mansions. And it's improper, illegitimate to make a clear distinction between the Enlightenment on one side and Romanticism on the other side. There's a good deal of overlap in all kinds of directions. But if one looks at Beethoven's whole 57 years of life, then I think one can see that the main thrust which is driving him is not reason but passion. So I do regard Beethoven primarily as a romantic figure, although, of course, he's not one who believes that irrationalism is something to be advocated.
Phil, in the end, we're talking about Beethoven. Geniuses are born, not made, aren't they?
What you are born with is unknown and remains the great unknown. But let's think about Beethoven. The First Symphony is written when he's 29 years old. And when he's 29, he's young, he's handsome, he's well-groomed. He knows exactly how to behave at court when he has to. There are times, it's true, when he could misbehave at court. And if he's asked to perform, he might put his arms down on the piano and say, that's my piece for tonight. I mean, he was temperamental, but he also knew how to behave. And again, what I find interesting is not the 5%, which is the unknown, which might make Beethoven the genius and someone else not the genius, but the 95% that we can analyse up to a point. The First Symphony, he's written it because he feels he's still trying to establish himself in Vienna. He feels he should write one. And he writes it because he wants to make some money from it. There's a fantastic letter. I mean, the place to start with Beethoven is the letters. And he writes his letters saying, I've written this symphony, now, and he writes off to a publisher, you know, buy it, and I'll throw in a couple of other things too. He's not writing these symphonies because he just has to. It's not that, you know, Amadeus has really caused us a problem as in the film, and Tom Hulce, this idea that you are leaning across a billiard table, throwing a billiard ball, drinking red wine, and it just all flows
it's
through.
It's sort of the bad boy of music image.
It wasn't like that. It was, to a great degree, like filmmaking, like being an author, is sheer hard work.
Tim.
Well, yes, all that is true, but it's not the entire picture, I don't think. I think that he was a genius, I've said that already, and I'd just like to flesh that out in two ways. One is that there was a recognition by those who knew him that he was a genius. So, for example, his first major teacher, Neefer, writes in a German periodical when Beethoven was just 13 years old, that he is a genius who, if he goes on as he is going at the moment, will one day emulate Mozart. So that's really from quite an early stage. And the other way in which I think I would support my assertion is that his contemporaries in Vienna, by the time he settles there permanently in 1794, treat him differently. They treat him differently from other musicians. So, for example, one of his earliest and most important patrons, Prince Lichnowsky, a great Silesian magnate, treats Beethoven as a friend. Beethoven stays with him as a friend. Indeed, Beethoven refers to him as my most ardent friend. And it's only on that basis that Beethoven will associate with people like Prince Lichnowsky or Lobkowitz, or indeed the emperor's own brother, the Archduke Rudolf. He regards them as friends and not simply as patrons.
Both you and Phil have talked about the way in which the status of the musician seems to change over quite a short period of time. What actually was the status of Beethoven himself during that time?
Well, I think there it has to be said that Beethoven makes his own luck, or he breaks the mould. I'm not sure what the right metaphor is. He had a very strong personality that came out from Henry's reading. And again, his life is very well documented. He was celebrated in his own lifetime. He had fans. I would actually stick my neck out and say he was the first composer to have fans as opposed to admirers, people who really wanted to know what he looked like. So there are
scores. Was he a celebrity?
He was a celeb, yes. There are scores and scores of images of Beethoven in every possible medium, including three dimensions. People wanted to know what this wonderful man looked like. He never travelled outside Vienna, he didn't travel very far from not outside the Habsburg monarchy anyway, after he arrived there. So I think that he has this immensely strong personality, and he really does bend the world to his will. And you can hear it in his music. Mm. In the Fifth Symphony tonight, for example, you will hear him bending the world to his will.
How does that actually manifest itself in the symphony, would you say, Tim?
Ba-ba-ba-bom. that's ba-ba-ba-bom. And you can hear it. You can hear him doing it. He's taking the world by its shoulders and giving it a jolly good shaking.
Well, I think we don't even need the orchestra after that, Tim. Thank you. But
And yet, bear in mind that when he was writing that, he would have tried it in all sorts of different ways. He'd have tried it backwards. He'd have tried five notes, four notes. Again, he's not a channel for this music.
How about this idea, Phil, of the personality? And again, this is a very romantic idea of the personality coming through in the music. I mean, one of the other pieces tonight is the First Symphony. Now, this surely is a big calling card, a big kind of generic change for Beethoven with his audience.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, he's showing off. You know, the beginning of the first...
How dare he?
Well, the beginning of the first movement, pizzicato start to it, he's saying, hey, look at me, I'm doing something different. It was often the case that the way in which he, again, when you analyse the chronology, analyse the history, analyse the economics, it affects the music.
And the question of economics actually leads us rather nicely into two more letters from Beethoven himself. Henry?
To the publishers Breitkopf and Hertel, Leipzig. Sirs, the fee for my work is much lower than what I usually accept. Send me back the manuscripts. I cannot and I will not accept a lower fee. Ludwig van Beethoven. To Dr. Franz Wegeler, November 16th, 1801. My life is again somewhat pleasanter, for I mix in society. You can scarcely imagine what a dreary, sad life I've led during the past 2 years. My weak hearing seemed always to be haunting me, and I ran away from people. I was forced to appear a misanthrope, though it's not at all in my character. And this change has been brought about by an enchanting maiden who loves me and whom I love. So once again, after 2 years, I've had some happy moments. And for the first time, I feel that marriage can bring happiness. Unfortunately, she's not of my station in life. And now, for the moment, I certainly cannot marry. I must bravely bustle about. If it were not for my hearing, I should already long ago have travelled half over the world. So that I must do. For me, there's no greater pleasure than that of practising and displaying my art.
Phil, this has almost become a cliché, hasn't it? The romantic artist is the man who's hopeless in love, hopeless with money. Are our ideas of what that kind of romantic artist is like shaped by Beethoven himself?
Are they shaped by Beethoven? Well, I mean, Beethoven's clearly been extremely influential on our notion of what is a romantic artist. And there are many that followed him, of course, whether it's Byron or Chopin. I hesitated there because I was trying to consider what you just said about being hopeless with money and hopeless in love. I mean, it's slightly more complex than that. And
Is an element of unattainability, particularly about his personal relationships, which we do associate with that kind of romantic idea of unattainable love.
Well, he had the misfortune of falling in love with women who were outside of his class, in the sense that they were of a class where either the women themselves or the fathers would say, there's no way you're marrying a mere musician. Yes, he was becoming this celebrity, but he was still considered to be a musician. He was a lower ranking. As far as money is concerned, this was a constant pressure on him, as you can imagine. Now, he actually hoarded pretty well. He did much better at it than Mozart. He's writing the Missa Solemnis, which is this wonderful work, and yet he's writing to all these kings saying, please, please buy it. I need the money. And he's trying to sell it to different publishers at the same time, saying it's exclusive work, don't worry.
And I think I'm right, he eventually appoints his brother as his agent, which turns out to be quite a good move in the end. But Tim, this idea of a very intense artist, which is really what we associate with the Romantic ideal, I mean, that is a culturally constructed idea, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But it's very clear in Beethoven's case, and we have a very authoritative authority on just that point, as Henry Redd. I mean, when Goethe met him in 1812, he said, this is the most intense artist I've ever met. No wonder he has problems assimilating himself to society.
I'd like us to take us, Tim, to the very end of Beethoven's life, the funeral. And I'm wondering how things have changed for composers up to the point that Beethoven dies. Because, of course, just 35, 36 years earlier, Mozart famously is buried in a pauper's grave, clearly not famously at the time. But the way that Beethoven went out of the world is really a huge contrast, isn't it?
Tremendous contrast. And it tells us a great deal about the change in the status of the musician between 1791 and 1827. It was known that Beethoven was dying. He'd had three or four operations early in 1827. His friends were ready for the event. Quite elaborate preparations had been made. And when he dies, invitations are sent out to the funeral. The funeral is a great occasion. School holiday was declared. No one knows quite how many people attended. Remember, Vienna's only about 250,000 people at the time. 20,000-30,000 maybe attended the funeral. It was such an event that a celebrated painter of the day, Franz Stuber, painted a celebrated representation of it, of Beethoven's coffin leaving the house of the black-robed Spaniard. The crush was such that it took hours for the coffin to be taken first to the church and then to the cemetery gates of the Währing Cemetery. And there, the greatest Austrian actor of the day, a man called Heinrich Anschütz, Henry's equivalent, declaimed an oration which had been written by the greatest poet and playwright of Austria of the day, Franz Grillparzer. And what is striking about this short but very eloquent funeral oration is that God is not mentioned once. The God to which Beethoven and Grillparzer paid their tribute was art.
And I think we can hear something from that funeral oration now. Henry.
The harp that is hushed. Let me call him so. For he was an artist, and all that was his through art alone. The thorns of life had wounded him deeply, and as the castaway clings to the shore, so did he seek refuge. Refuge in your arms, O glorious sister and peer of the good and true, balm of wounded hearts, heaven-born art. He was an artist. And who shall arise to stand beside him? Thus he was, thus he died, thus he will live to the end of time. All of you, however, who have followed us today, let not your hearts be troubled. You have not lost him, you have won him. And should you ever, in times to come, feel the overpowering might of his creations like an onrushing storm, when your mounting ecstasy overflows in the midst of a generation yet unborn, then remember this hour. And think, we were there when they buried Beethoven, and when he died, we wept.
Many thanks indeed to my guests here tonight, Tim Blanning, Phil Grabsky, and Henry Goodman. Thank you very much.
Rana Mitter was talking to the film director Phil Grabsky and the historian and author Tim Blanning. The reader was Henry Goodman, and the programme was produced by Dimpfner Film. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second of our Beethoven proms of the season. I'm Katie Derham, and you've just been hearing the Prommers announcing their charity collection for the night. In the second half of tonight's prom, though, is fate about to knock at our door as the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie of Bremen prepares to play what must be one of the best-known pieces of classical music in the world, Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. The conductor tonight is the Estonian Paavo Järvi, member of a great conducting dynasty. His father is Neeme Järvi. Paavo has been artistic director of the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie since 2004, and he's just finished recording all Beethoven's symphonies with them. They're currently on tour with the programme that we're hearing tonight. Violinist Hilary Hahn is certainly a huge fan of both conductor and orchestra, and she spoke incredibly warmly to me earlier about the on-stage relationship that Paavo Järvi has with this particular orchestra. Well, he spoke to me earlier, very engagingly too, about the pieces that they're performing tonight and why he feels there is always room for new interpretations of Beethoven's works.
A person who has seen a World War I will see these pieces differently than the person who has seen World War II. And a person who hasn't seen any world wars but has seen Berlin Wall collapse will maybe see a Beethoven Ninth and Ode to Joy yet differently, and next generation will see it in their own view. So there is no such thing as a definitive performance. There is only a performance that can be honest and as honestly thought through and felt through as one can at that moment.
So what way are we going to hear?
I think we're going to hear a Beethoven that is much more tempestuous. We tried to avoid any kind of pomposity. The larger-than-life, the kind of Gustav Mahler arrangement where you add 8 horns and a tuba just to make the point, that is not possible or necessary for us because we are a Kammerphilharmonie. We play these pieces exactly with the same forces as Beethoven did. So I think that even the first opening statement has to communicate a certain drive, a certain impatience, certain energy that is not da ba ba ba. This is not a kind of loaded, overly dramatic in a most late romantic way, but it's almost like a code out of which a lot of new things will then develop and come. It is really the cell, it's the atom that actually allows to create the whole symphony. And I think that looking at it that way helps us at least to keep a closer watch on the structure. Tempi are very important. It may come as a surprise to a lot of people, but there is no real slow movement in this symphony, like there is no real slow movement in Eroica, for example. But late romantic understanding is that a good symphony has to have a slow movement, and if Beethoven wrote a fast metronome, that means he was probably deaf and his metronome didn't work. And we maybe don't entirely believe in this myth either.
A very interesting man, Paavo Järvi, talking to me earlier. He's getting a fantastic sound from this orchestra, his dear Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie from Bremen. There was a very good quote I read about Paavo Järvi, actually, which said he clearly prizes highly charged music making, often at top speed, with thoughtful phrasing and sharply punched accents. These qualities yield refreshing, powerful performances. A very apt quote, having listened to the first half. And I should just reiterate, if you didn't hear the first half, if you're just joining me now, then do go to the website when you get a chance, the Radio 3 website, to listen again. It'll be on there for the next 7 days. It really was phenomenal. Beethoven's First Symphony and Hilary Hahn playing the violin concerto in D major. But here he comes now, Paavo Järvi, to conduct the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie of Bremen in Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. Listen out for those surprises.
We'll be right back. Thank you.
wasn't that the most wonderful performance of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony? Paavo Järvi conducting the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie from Bremen. He promised us some surprises. He said he liked to push the tempi. My goodness, in that opening statement in the first movement, he really, really went at quite a lick, didn't he? It had all the grandeur that you'd hope for in Beethoven's Fifth, and yet somehow it was cheeky as well. Wonderful. And that was a chamber orchestra making that big noise. Just three basses, just six cellos. My goodness, they played so together. They were so focused. The sound was immense. Absolutely wonderful playing. Paavo Järvi coming back onto the stage now to this rapturous applause from the crowd here. A packed Royal Albert Hall, stamping as you can hear. Bringing the soloists to their feet. You can tell from the way they interact with their conductor how much they respect him and how much they like him. I think they're all being brought up to their feet, one by one, and now all together. The wind section standing now to receive the applause. Now the horns. Now the trumpets. Those original natural trumpets that I referred to earlier, now the trombones. I think everybody's going to get a look in. The kettle drum, he's just got a big cheer. And now the string section. Really a wonderful orchestra, hugely appreciated here. I confess I'm slightly obsessed with conductors ever since I took part in Maestro, but it was so interesting watching him conduct. He has a sort of sad clown face, a wonderful theatrical range of expressions and gestures, which get this lyrical and colourful palette of sound, if you like, from the orchestra. Theatrical and yet not showy. Really a very interesting man to watch. It's a young orchestra, this orchestra that, as you can hear, the audience would like to hear again. The Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie has only been around since 1987. A lot of the members of the orchestra are really very young as well. They're in the process of recording all of Bruckner's symphonies now, 7 and 9 already out there, I think, for your listening pleasure, ladies and gentlemen. Here he comes back onto the stage, Paavo Järvi, taking everybody to their feet again. I wonder if we'll get an encore. I think he just might. Paavo Järvi on the podium again, taking another bow. I think the signs are good. Let's hear the encore. Thank you. And as Paolo Jovi introduced it, Beethoven. In fact, that was the Allegretto Scherzando from Beethoven's 8th Symphony. And that's a work that you won't be able to hear anywhere else this season at the Proms. So an extra little added bonus for you tonight. A wonderful finale there to a really excellent prom from the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie of Bremen under the expert baton of Paavo Järvi. It's not the last Beethoven this week. You'll be able to hear Paul Lewis, who's back to perform Beethoven's second piano concerto on Thursday. That's one not to miss. And tomorrow night, you'll be able to join us for a prom featuring the BBC Symphony Orchestra under Oliver Nussen. In a very different programme to tonight, that's for sure. It's a programme of Stockhausen, Birtwistle, Matthews, Bedford, Zimmerman and Schumann. Looking ahead to the weekend, don't miss Saturday's Sondheim at 80 prom. That'll be live here on Radio 3, of course, but I'll also be presenting that one live on BBC 2. And I'll be talking to the great man himself during the interval as well, so I'm already overexcited about that. But as Paavo Järvi takes yet another bow to his adoring crowds here at the Royal Albert Hall, it's time for me to say goodnight and to hand you back to Broadcasting House and my colleague, Jonathan Swain.
Katie, thank you very much. Katie Derham there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom again on Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
In just over 5 minutes' time tonight, Ideas, the British version. More on that in a moment. Then at 11 o'clock, The Essay. Now, music might feature in the work of a good many writers, but do that many writers actually play an instrument? More than you might expect, apparently. And this week's essay charts four writers with musical careers, so to speak, and how playing relates to their lives as writers. They're also keen to demonstrate their musical talents, which you can hear at the end of each essay. Novelist Louise Doughty tonight discusses how learning to play the piano in 2008 presented her with a fresh challenge. That's at 11 o'clock tonight. Until then, music making from the Austrian mezzo Angelika Kirschlager. Here she is in songs by Alma Mahler, songs she wrote in the years before, immediately before she married Gustav Mahler. While they were engaged, he wrote to her, "How do you picture the married life of a husband and wife who are both composers? Have you any idea how ridiculous and degrading such a competitive relationship would be? You must become what I need." Well, this is Alma Mahler's In My Father's Garden. Angelika Kirschlager here with pianist Helmut Deutsch.
Oh.
In My Father's Garden by Alma Mahler, or Alma Schindler, as she was when she wrote the song just before she married Gustav Mahler. The performers there, mezzo Angelika Kirschlager and pianist Helmut Deutsch. Alma, by the way, studied with Zemlinsky. It's now 10 o'clock, and now on BBC Radio 3, another chance to hear Ideas, the British Version, the series in which historian and now Labour MP Tristram Hunt traces the path of ideas that have emerged in this country and then spread beyond our shores. In this opening programme, first broadcast last September, Tristram follows the story of Halford Mackinder and the Heartland Theory.
Hanging in the corner of Wantage Hall dining room at the University of Reading, above a service door to the kitchens, is the portrait of an eminent Victorian. Mustachioed, with a wing collar, in his academic gowns, he's everything a founder of the University of Reading should look like. But Sir Halford John Mackinder was one of the most influential thinkers of the 20th century. His idea of geopolitics transformed military thinking, diplomacy, and political science. He was a thinker on a grand scale, conceiving Europe, Africa, Asia as a total world island.
Who rules East Europe commands the heartland.
I've now caught the train from Reading towards London to find out more about Mackinder's vision of the impact of geography on world politics and the crucial importance of what he called the heartland. In this programme, I want to explore how the ideas of this long-forgotten Englishman found their way first to Nazi Germany, then to Cold War America, and how they still resonate today.
Who rules the heartland, commands the world island? Who rules the world island, commands the world?
We start not in the chambers of the Foreign Office or the American Embassy, but here on a street corner in Mayfair, opposite a gloriously Italianate building. Today it's a gallery. It was once the Museum of Mankind. But 100 years ago, on the 25th of January 1904, it played host to a talk given by Halford Mackinder for the Royal Geographical Society. With me here is Geoffrey Sloan of the University of Reading, an expert on Mackinder. So, Geoff, we've now walked into what is now a very stark, whitewashed modern art gallery on the upper floor. Tell us about the celebrated lecture which Mackinder delivered here in 1904 with the great title of The Geographical Pivot of History.
He identifies two geographical areas: a large configuration of forest in north and northwest Russia, and grassy steppe in Eurasia.
So this is the idea of the heartland. He's sketching out this heartland, which he's pacing at the geographical pivot of history, a huge landmass.
Yes, he is. He identifies this mass of Eurasia, which is 21 million square miles, half of the all land of the globe, which was landlocked, which could not be really reached by maritime power through the use of rivers, because the rivers flowed into the frozen wastes or into these salt lakes.
So this is very much a focus then on land armies, on land mass, a different locus of power rather than Britain with its massive Royal Navy.
Yes, indeed. What Mackinder was suggesting was that if that area was to develop in terms of its political organisation and in terms of the development of its natural resources, it could overset the balance of power, and then an empire which would threaten the Western maritime empires would be in sight. Mackinder also spotted the fact that Russia had just been fighting a war at the end of a railway track thousands of miles long in the Far East. For the first time in world history, if you like, with these developments in transport technology and weapons technology, it was possible to have in the future a world empire.
How would it see off the threat from sea power, i.e. from British naval power?
He maintains that if this pivot area would expand over I suppose what you could describe as the Eurasian Rimland, it would then have the resources for fleet building and could then challenge the ability of the Western maritime powers to exercise sea control.
The 1900s is a time of tension. British Empire at its zenith, but also worrying about decline, threats of German competition, threats of American competition as well, and now this idea of the heartland and Russia. And this seems to come out in this passage.
Yes, indeed. The oversetting of the balance of power in favour of the pivot state, resulting in its expansion over the marginal lands of Eurasia, would permit
of the use of vast continental resources for fleet building. And the empire of the world would then be in sight. This might happen if Germany were to ally herself with Russia.
In the wake of the First World War, it seemed the land power of Germany was no longer quite such a threat. Yet in 1919, against the tide of hope for a permanent peace settlement at the Versailles Conference, Mackinder published a book, Democratic Ideals and Reality, and his vision of the danger of a single power taking control of the heartland now became an urgent warning.
He coins his famous geopolitical catechism. And what Mackinder suggests is that when our statesmen are in conversation with the defeated enemy, they need to have, as he put it, some airy cherub who would whisper in their ears, who rules East Europe controls the heartland, who rules the heartland commands the world island, and who rules the world island commands the world. Moving our focus away from inner Eurasia to focus on Eastern Europe.
And this is extraordinarily precipitant, isn't it, in terms of 1919, in terms of what's going to happen over the next 20 years in European history, to focus on Eastern Europe, the looming struggle between Germans and Slavs, the struggle for power there. It was on the button there, wasn't it?
What's extraordinary about democratic ideals and reality is that it fades very, very quickly. It does not have the impact, perhaps, that it should have.
In Britain, at least, Mackinder was a prophet without honour. But his ideas were picked up in Germany itself. As Geoffrey Sloane and Holger Herwig of the University of Calgary explain, a certain German army officer turned geopolitical thinker had been reading Mackinder avidly. This was Karl Haushofer.
Haushofer was deeply, deeply shocked by World War I, by Germany's defeat. And for him, the world was divided very simplistically into the haves and the have-nots.
One of the things that had struck Haushofer when he'd gone out to Japan as a military attaché, that everywhere his ship stopped, he saw the Union Jack, and there was a British coaling station or a naval base.
And he tried to make that clear in a famous drawing showing the world with Britain as a big black octopus, its tentacles going out to Vancouver, the Falklands, even Vladivostok and Archangel. And Haushofer argued that after the Versailles settlement, there needed to be a new redivision of Europe. And Germany needed the room to expand.
And his one great idea is taking Mackinder's ideas of a heartland and giving it a twist. He said that Germany should try and develop what he calls a transcontinental line free of Anglo-Saxons.
And so Haushofer, basing his thinking on Mackinder, came up with the notion of a Japan-Russia-Germany alliance that would dominate the world because it was the largest contiguous heartland to counter the old status quo Anglo-Saxon countries. Mackinder was absolutely the great influence on Haushofer's intellectual development.
And then, still reeling from Germany's defeat, Haushofer came across two ambitious young men.
He manages to get a job as a lecturer in geography at the University of Munich. And into one of his lectures walks one day another recently demobilized officer, Captain Rudolf Hess. And Hesse is very much taken with Haushofer's ideas, and he invites him to go to a particular beer cellar where there's a recently demobilized corporal that he introduces him to.
What ideas was Haushofer imparting to Hesse, which then we think might have made their way toward Hitler?
Haushofer took Hesse under his wings and introduced him to the readings and geopolitics of Friedrich Ratzel, of Rudolf Killain, of Helfried Mackinder. In the summer of 1924, when Hitler and Hesse were incarcerated in Landsberg after the Beer Hall Putsch, Haushofer, without remuneration, went out every Wednesday and instructed the two of them, whom he called the Young Lions, on those geopolitical readings. Most importantly, the whole issue of Lebensraum.
As far as Mackinder's concerned, the real link is that in 1923, Haushofer pays out of his own pocket for Mackinder's democratic ideals and reality to be translated into German. When I interviewed Frau Hesse in 1978, I remember her taking me into her drawing room and pulling off the shelf a German edition of Democratic Ideals and Reality, which was actually signed by Karl Haushofer. So there's the evidence that there was a direct link.
As he pushed his Mackinder-influenced ideas in print and on radio, Haushofer became a national figure, feted by leading Nazis. Whether he was a decisive influence on Hitler is much debated. But Holger Herwig contends that he shaped at least one crucial moment. On the 24th of August 1939, a shocked world woke up to the news that the Nazis and the Soviets were allies.
This was the fulfillment of everything he had written about since 1913. Tokyo, Moscow, Berlin as the great counterweight to the Anglo-Saxon maritime world.
So there was a real sense that the heartland, this mass land power, could now begin to challenge the English octopus.
Absolutely. The tentacles could now finally be chopped off.
Suddenly, Mackinder was sprung from obscurity. As Brian Blouet, his biographer, showed me, within 3 days of the Nazi-Soviet pact being signed, a short, anonymous article appeared in a British political magazine.
In front of us is a copy of the New Statesman Nation, as it then was, from the 26th of August, 1939, with an article entitled Hitler's World Revolution. This New Statesman article begins with the Russo-German agreement, i.e. the Nazi-Soviet pact, does not come as a complete surprise to those who have studied closely the ideas which have been shaping the policy of the Nazi leaders.
It is putting up the idea that Mackinder stated first in 1904 that if Russia and Germany became allies, then the empire of the world will be in sight.
So that's very much a clear connection, they see it, to Haushofer's ideas reaching back to Mackinder, influencing the development of this pact.
Yes, and it goes on. Many of the ideas have been, quote, stolen from the intellectual arsenal of British imperialism.
Whatever the lines of influence really were in Germany, the idea that Mackinder's heartland theory lay behind the Nazis' Russian strategy caught hold. Then, in 1941, Hitler decided to take the heartland by force and invaded his new Soviet ally. As Brian Blouet told me, all this provoked a new flurry of interest in Mackinder in America.
Well, Mackinder gets rediscovered in the US. We get this great surge of articles in 41, 42. All the big journals carried these stories. Newsweek, Time, everybody. And we've got a Life article here. And it's reflected in film as well. Frank Capra makes a series of propaganda films, one of which is The Nazi Strike.
Hitler's step-by-step plan for world conquest can be summarized this way. Conquer Eastern Europe, and you dominate the heartland. Conquer the heartland, and you dominate the world island. Conquer the world island, and you dominate the world. That was a dream in Hitler's mind as he stood at Nuremberg.
You couldn't really have a clearer explanation of Mackinder's heartland theory for a mass audience than that.
No, I mean, it's as if somebody sat down to write the script with democratic ideals and reality in front of them.
It seems an incredibly sophisticated piece of wartime propaganda that one needs to explain the ideological reasoning of the enemy. But I suppose in doing so, it gives a very clear threat to the American audience that this is about world control and world hegemony.
Yes, I don't think there's any doubt when you watch that picture that it is propaganda designed to get the public behind the war and to see the long-term threat.
One of the longest analyses of Mackinder and then Haushofer and then geopolitics is in Life magazine, complete with large maps of land masses showing Mackinder's analysis of the heartland. And what was the message behind this one?
I would say this is a very thoroughly researched article. This article, late in 1942, is entitled Geopolitics, the Lurid Career of a Scientific System which a Briton Invented, the Germans Used, and Americans Need to Study.
What a great headline. It goes on to begin with a lurid story in itself of an attractive blonde in Washington, D.C., who is frequenting the campus of Georgetown University, and she seems particularly interested in the lectures of Father Edmund A. Walsh. She sought frequent conferences with him to discuss her studies in private. And it goes on to suggest that she was trying to find out what the Americans thought about geopolitics and what they knew about the ideas of Haushofer and Mackinder.
And she's of German origin, and when the war starts, she's picked up.
Yes, she was a German agent sent to frame the good father by creating a scandal, but she never had a chance to carry out her plot. So she was going to undermine the man who knew most about the Haushofer vision of geopolitics until the FBI picked her up.
Here we are almost at the opening scene of a spy movie.
It's very Graham Greene, isn't it? Father Walsh is a kindly, peaceable man, an eminent scholar and a Jesuit priest, hardly the man to inspire a foreign government to melodramatic plots against him. But the Gestapo might explain it in a word: geopolitics. I mean, never has, you know, political geography seemed so sexy.
No. Towards the end of the article, we are given a list of the distinguished American geographers who are making a true American school of geopolitics.
So these ideas have really come across the Atlantic at this stage.
Yes, very much so.
Among the intellectuals name-checked by Life magazine as America's leading geopoliticians, one in particular cuts a vivid figure. Father Edmund A. Walsh. It was from here, in Washington, at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, which he founded, that Father Walsh pioneered American geopolitics. So I followed the trail of the Heartland Theory to America, and I'm now sitting in a quadrangle at Georgetown University with a burbling fountain in the middle, a chapel at one end, whilst overhead, aircraft are coming into land at Ronald Reagan International, bringing the power brokers of today to the capital of the United States. This is a perfect setting to talk about Father Walsh, a man with one foot in the ethereal academic camp, another in the State Department and the Pentagon. Joining me is Charles Kupchan, Professor of International Affairs at what is now the Walsh School of Foreign Service here at Georgetown. When do Americans first become aware of Mackinder and his heartland theory?
It really wasn't until the 1920s, partly as a result of Edmund Walsh's reading of Haushofer, that Mackinder's ideas began to seep into the United States. It's important to keep in mind that the United States, after the First World War, turned inward. And the founding of the School of Foreign Service coincided with the founding of the Council on Foreign Relations and other similar institutions, which were intended to instill in Americans a more ambitious and enlightened brand of internationalism. So Walsh and his fellow travelers were convinced that the United States had to play a role that went beyond the Western Hemisphere. And that thinking was really based upon a fundamental insight of Mackinder, that if a country came to dominate the Eurasian heartland, it could threaten countries far afield. That was one of the key pieces of logic that got Roosevelt and the United States into World War II. And then after the war, interestingly, Walsh became affiliated with the Nuremberg trials as a consultant. And that's because of his expertise on German geopolitics.
So, with the Nazis defeated, Father Walsh was asked to investigate the relationship between geopolitics and the war. As Holger Herwig explains, he was sent to interrogate Haushofer himself.
In the end, he got everything he wanted out of Haushofer. Yes, I took my terminology from Mackinder. I learned the heartland from Mackinder. And then I put it in a German setting. And through Rudolf Hess, I gave it to Hitler. But in the end, Hitler didn't understand it, didn't listen to me, and got it wrong. Walsh came to the conclusion that, yes, Haushofer had a direct influence with Hitler, that he provided the geopolitical underpinnings for Nazi expansion, but that he should not stand trial. And as he informed Justice Jackson, quote, nature will probably dispose of this case in a short time. After the interrogation by Father Walsh, Haushofer virtually had closed off his life. And in March of 1946, the young son, Heinz Haushofer, came to the farm to pick his mother up. He found a suicide note in which Haushofer said, I want to be forgotten and forgotten.
Walsh was an important figure in the period in the sense that he was a Russia/Soviet specialist. He believed that Soviet communism had to stop.
So part of his significance is crucially taking Mackinder's thinking forward to that post-World War II containment debate about the new threat in terms of the heartland from the Soviet Russia.
I think that if there were a sort of key insight that has most shaped American thinking about the world, it is simply that no country can be allowed to dominate the Eurasian landmass. That is an insight that can be directly traced back to Mackinder, to Haushofer, to Walsh.
Walsh wasn't the only person starting to focus on the potential post-war threat of the Soviets. J.D. Crouch is a former Deputy National Security Advisor in the Bush White House. As he and Brian Bluet explain, an academic at Yale University was also drawing on lessons from Mackinder. His name was Nicholas Spykman.
He comes right out and says, look, a German empire from the North Sea to the Urals is a threat, but a Soviet empire from the Urals to the North Sea is just as big a threat.
He wrote a series of very important articles on this subject, which culminated in a book published in 1942 called America's Strategy in World Politics. And he adapted Mackinder's theory to the American setting.
He comes up with this other term, Rimland. In other words, the fight between the sea powers and the land powers of the heartland is going to take place in Western Europe, Southern Europe, the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, Southeast Asia, and the Far East.
And basically argued, somewhat at odds with Mackinder's view that the heartland was the dominant geographic pole in the world, that the heartland could be contained by controlling what he called the rimlands. If the other side, the Eastern Hemisphere, fell under organized and hostile control, this would not be in America's interests.
So the American press was full of geopolitics and the heartland theory and the Nazi plan for world domination. And more seriously, defence intellectuals like Walsh and Spikeman were growing ever more engaged with these ideas and were beginning to reshape them for a world that would no longer be threatened by Nazi Germany, but by Soviet Russia. This is the office of Foreign Affairs magazine in New York, the house journal of the East Coast foreign policy elite. It's in a townhouse on the Upper East Side, full of marble and thick doors, replete with establishment grandeur. I've come here to meet Gideon Rose of Foreign Affairs magazine to find out why in 1942, amidst all the fuss in the press about the Heartland Theory, his magazine tried to contact Mackinder himself.
The editor of Foreign Affairs during most of this period is a man named Hamilton Fish Armstrong, a pillar of the WASP establishment, a real old guard type. But he's trying to keep serious thought and discussion alive about foreign policy and international relations all during the interwar years through his journal.
And he's come across Mackinder's thinking.
There's a new edition of Mackinder's Democratic Ideals and Reality. Hamilton Fish Armstrong asks Mackinder if he would write an article saying, is this something that is relevant to the current crisis?
And what's Mackinder's response to this?
Mackinder's,
he's now an elderly gentleman.
Mackinder's 82 at this
point. In retirement in Dorset. That's one of the telegrams, is it?
Yeah, February 27th. This is the telegram from Mackinder to Armstrong. Article now complete and on road by official fast airmail. Stop. This is psychological moment. Please print in spring issue if in any way practical. Mackinder.
So Mackinder still, even in his early 80s, he's still got a feel for the importance of his ideas and making the intervention at the right moment.
Absolutely.
But at the moment in 1943, the threat is still the heartland, and it doesn't matter if it's a sort of German-led heartland or a Russian-led heartland.
He says here at one point, all things considered, the conclusion is unavoidable that if the Soviet Union emerges from this war as conqueror of Germany, she must rank as the greatest land power on the globe. Moreover, she will be the power in the strategically strongest defensive position. The heartland is the greatest natural fortress on Earth. For the first time in history, it's manned by a garrison sufficient both in number and quality. But that, taken out of context, seems like he's talking about we need to contain the Soviet Union in the heartland. That's a landmine that will only explode in later years. Because in the context of the article, he sets that up as this is what's going to contain Germany to the east. So we need to construct a power comparably strong in the west to hem Germany
in. What the correspondent strikingly reveals is that key sections of Mackinder's article, The Round World and the Winning of the Peace, were prompted by the questions of his American editor, not least this crucial section, which foreshadows America's post-war strategy.
My second geographical concept is that of the Midland Ocean, the North Atlantic, and its dependent seas and river basins. Let us picture it in its three elements as a bridgehead in France, a moated aerodrome in Britain, and a reserve of agriculture and industry in the eastern United States and Canada. Now, this is very interesting. He basically argues that America provides strategic depth like the Russian plain, and that together, the United States, Britain, and France represent a strategic force and a geopolitical force equal to and opposed to that of the Soviet Union.
Many critics have suggested you're beginning to see, certainly how the Americans receive it, notions of containment of the Soviet Union.
It's not about the containment of Russia yet. What's fascinating, however, is how this easily can evolve into what we now know as containment later. So if you take the German problem as settled and you skip ahead to the late 40s, it's fascinating to see the elements of what containment will become if you simply drop Germany out of the picture. A few years after Mackinder's article appeared in Foreign Affairs, perhaps the most famous Foreign Affairs article of all time appeared by the person who was then the policy planning director of the State Department, George Frost Kennan, and it was a piece in 1947 on containment and the doctrine that would guide American foreign policy later. It basically takes many of the components of Mackinder's geopolitics and applies them in a new context. The next problem has emerged, how to keep the Soviet Union imbalanced and checked. And so the elements of what Mackinder was talking about in terms of the political alliance between the United States, Great Britain, and France, counterbalancing the Soviet Union's heartland, ends up being NATO and the Warsaw Pact later on.
We get NATO, we get the Southeast Asian treaty organization. We get a defense treaty with the Philippines. We get a defense treaty with Japan. In other words, we have put up around the Rimland a great containing group of bases and allies.
This was a sea change in American foreign policy, and I think Mackinder and Spikeman's intellectual influence helped to guide that.
So in the post-war world, Mackinder's heartland theory, for a time at least, reached the very core of America.